Divided Kingdom, the evening news program with a Christian emphasis, the hard-hitting truth that you're not going to hear in the mainstream media. This is Elizabeth Cuppet Caverly, and tonight Lou Caverly and I have Captain Darrell Eberhart riding shotgun with us. So it's a very important program. You really are going to want to listen to it, and you're going to want to let others know about our program, which can be heard on WWCR Thursday evenings on 4.840 megahertz. That's 4840 at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursday evenings on WWCR on both shortwave and on the Internet. And you can also hear it on the Liberty Works Radio Network, which is LWRN.net. That's LWRN.net. You can go to their website. They have an app. You can hear us on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, repeating at 11 p.m. And they also have some archival programs from us, too, later in the week when you visit their website. And we've had a little problem with our own archives. So if some of you have been not able to find the newer programs after the year 2015, soon, within about a week, our wonderful producer will have that up and running, that you can really tell your friends to hear some of these programs. They can look at the programs Captain Eberhart has had from February 26th, I believe, was a very important one, and that repeated in early summer. He's been talking about things that are very important, the real truth about the Civil War, the Jesuit connection. He's been talking about the CIA. And so now I must just give you a little quick news, and we will be telling you a little bit about the state of Islam again, because things are on the move. And you won't believe, all the danger is not just in Europe. It's coming here. It's actively coming here. So you do want to stay tuned for later in the program to hear about Smithville, North Carolina. You definitely do. And Captain Eberhart has a lot of information, too, from Crescent Moon Rising and more. But I'd like to just give you a little quick news blitz. We're always interested in what's happening with the abortion issue. And you know that we have been sharing the newsletters of Dan and Donna Holman and Pastor Dale Henkel for quite some time. And the latest communication from Dan Holman is really heartening. July 1st, 2017, Keokuk, and this is in Iowa, Keokuk Planned Parenthood closed for good. Dan Holman says, its doors are locked, its signs are gone. I took these pictures June 23rd, 2017, before they moved out. Donna was recovering from hip surgery at Keokuk Hospital, next door to Planned Parenthood. And so we see a real estate sign there, and we just see that it's going out of business. Isn't this wonderful? And then he gives us a little more data about Donna's trial, and this goes back to the year 2014. Donna's pretrial motion to dismiss was heard in South Lee County, Iowa, on December 17, 2014. Usually these motions are reserved for an appeal. However, the restraining order, RO, is very badly written in that it is overbroad and vague. It does not specify who she was enjoined to keep away from. Since the restraining order, the RO, was written, Planned Parenthood of Greater Iowa had changed its corporate name to Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. Oh, isn't that just refreshing? You know, killing and maiming of the babies, selling their parts, Heartland. You know, it should make everybody's hearts bleed. Keokuk Planned Parenthood, where Donna was arrested March 10, 2014, was not incorporated as either Planned Parenthood of the Heartland or Planned Parenthood of Greater Iowa. Judge Karen Edgerton extended the RO to 2022 while it was on appeal. Edgerton did not have jurisdiction to do this while Donna's appeal was in the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisdiction. But being a judge means never having to say, I'm sorry, or to admit to wrongdoing. And then he quotes the Bible, and I do not want any of you to write me letters that this wasn't the King James Version. Shame on you if you want to criticize these elderly people who are standing out there trying to save the babies. Jesus said, settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Matthew 5:25. In a land where child murder and sexual perversion is a civil right, justice is seldom obtained. We'll get more into Dale Henkels probably in a later program, but there were some strange attacks there on preterm, where he is. I believe he's in Cleveland, Ohio. And finally, the camera showed it was a young black teenager who threw these rocks and broke the window. So the FBI isn't really questioning any of the pro-lifers. I guess this may just be, maybe this is an indirect hand of God, you see, through the black teenager, because it's all the black people who are in this genocide. And now we move on to some of the hard-hitting news that's coming out of InfoWars from Roger Stone, because we are all knowing that we have a brief reprieve, perhaps, but we hope it's a long reprieve under Donald Trump. But we really have to keep praying, and we have to watch this whole situation. And Roger Stone gives the impression that Jeff Sessions may be on the way out, and that CIA Director Michael Pompeo may be in the front line to be the successor. And this is of great concern to Roger Stone, because he said Pompeo's speech at the Aspen Institute concerned a speech in which he was parroting the anti-Russian theme. So if Trump values loyalty, one would question whether he would really be a front runner. And, of course, we are all happy about Sarah Huckabee Sanders becoming the press secretary. And he said that if Rance Priebus is going to be replaced as chief of staff, there could be three possibilities. One is David Urban, a decorated veteran who helped Trump's campaign in Pennsylvania, and he's pretty much a hardliner for Trump. But the second possibility was very, very troubling to all of us. Dina Abid Powell, and she's a certified globalist, according to Roger Stone. And guess who her best friend is, Lou? Uma Abedin. Mm. Have you heard that name before?
Oh, yes.
Yes, Hillary's good friend. And then the third one could be a wild card, General John Kelly. And Stone thinks that we can't really tell completely whether he's a globalist or not. And he said Anthony Scaramucci is doing well as the White House communications director. But Stone brought up some interesting things. He said that under Jeff Sessions, there was a failure to prosecute some important people, and one was John Brennan. And we already know, years back when we were interviewing Carol Matriciana, FBI man John Guandolo reported how Brennan had converted to Islam. And then there was also the failure, of course, to prosecute Bill and Hillary. And with all these things that are leaking about the uranium, all of this deal with Russia, one would wonder. But, you know, Roger Stone says that this scandal, now this is a little different aspect of it. David Knight brought out how the FISA court actually came out with the results that the FBI and NSA violated all the Americans' privacy with the surveillance. And he's saying, why wasn't there any prosecution here of Obama and his cohorts? And Roger Stone made an interesting comment. He said, this scandal is the key to Trump's survival. And, of course, Stone says he doesn't think Mike Pompeo will prosecute anybody for this. And at the same time, in the last week or so, Paul Ryan came out extolling Mueller as Mueller threatens to enlarge the investigation. So we see that the plot is on the move. It very definitely is. And we have to wonder why we have this inertia. When Roger Stone says in answer, when will this leaking stop? When the president finally appoints new people, 80% are still Obama loyalists. We have to really wonder. We hope that Trump isn't a double agent at this point. There's still so much vitriol against him that we think that he, at heart, the basic person he is an American, does love America, wants Americans to prosper. But we really do have to watch this situation. And at the same time, now something new is coming out on Sean Hannity, especially, is starting to bring this out in the mainstream media. And Lee Stranahan was reporting on InfoWars. And if you want to go to his website, it would be the thepopulist.tv. Again, that's thepopulist.tv. And what he's reporting is that the Democratic National Committee was head over heels involved with the Ukraine government trying to interfere with the elections. Now, you haven't heard a bit about that. You only hear about Russia. But according to Stranahan's reports, Alexandra Chalipo, who has the close connections to the DNC, was involved with a serial bomber, and his name was Brett Kimberlin. And he had already spent 17 years in prison, but he had the money bags. He was the money guy, the bag man, and he was working in conjunction with a foreign national named Jonathan Schwartz. And so apparently Alexandra, you see, was here in America, Chalupo, and she made sure the connections were there so that this foreign national, Schwartz, could go talk to people in Capitol Hill. Now, who set up these Capitol Hill meetings? I think perhaps David Knight on InfoWars asked that very vital question. But this was all going on, and then BuzzFeed reported about this, too. That there were, guess what, George Soros connections to the money and the bag man and all of it. So Lee Stranahan made a very significant point, I thought. He said, if you demonize Russia, you can cover up the Syria involvement with ISIS, how our government, John McCain and the others, were really working there with the Ukraine, and all of that was going on, too. So those two things. Our involvement, the CIA and Hillary and Obama arming ISIS, and the Ukrainian government, in which he said actually Victoria Nuland, there was some kind of a phone leak that she was picking the new government for the Ukrainians. We shouldn't be doing this. We should be doing what George Washington told us to do, working with our own country. But these are all things to watch, and we do ask you to pray very strongly for the wisdom and power of Donald Trump, and the spiritual guidance. Lou, would you make a prayer right now for our president and for our Christians who are in the remnant in this country?
Let's all pray together. Oh, Lord, we just ask that you'll grant President Trump wisdom, knowledge, the power to do the right thing, that you'll protect him from adversaries who are unfairly ganging up on him, that you will just help him to do what is right in your eyes. And we just pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
And I hadn't planned on this, but I think we will get a brief response here from Captain Eberhardt, who's really prepared to do a lot on Islam, but he also worked with the NSA. He is very familiar with what the CIA is doing. And I'd ask you, Daryl, is it somewhat troubling to you that the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, might get a more leading role in the administration?
Yes, I agree 100% with the analysis that they did on the Alex Jones show today. And these guys are all together. A lot of these guys at the very top levels of the intelligence community are not, in my view, patriotic Americans. The vast majority of them are with the globalist agenda. And so I don't think that he would indeed go after any of the super criminals that we got, especially on the Democratic side, but they're also on the Republican establishment side to a certain degree also. So, no, he's part of the Good Buddies Club of all of these people that are very, very high up in, tied in with a lot of ties that we wouldn't want to have examining, trying to ferret out evil. I don't think that he would be of any value there.
Thank you so much. And now I'm going to move to another cutting edge happening. And of course, we're coming to you here in late July, so this was Monday, July 17th, 2017. Teenager appears in court over London acid attacks. Kevin Rawlinson. A teenager faces trial over a series of acid attacks allegedly committed in London in the space of less than 90 minutes last week. The 16-year-old boy, who cannot be named because of his age, appeared in a youth court in East London on Monday, accused of carrying out attacks on six victims on July 13th. He pleaded not guilty to one count of wounding, as well as five counts of attempted grievous bodily harm. He also denied two robberies, four attempted robberies, and one charge of possession of a weapon. The district judge, Jonathan Radway, sent each of those charges to Wood Green Crown Court for trial, with the first hearing set for August 14th, while two more unrelated charges are to be tried at Stratford Youth Court at a later date. The defendant wore a gray tracksuit and spoke only to confirm his details and enter the not guilty pleas. The court heard that one of the alleged victims could lose sight in one eye as a result of the attacks. Sarah, and that's spelled capital S-A-I-R-A, Nisar, and that's spelled capital N-I-S-A-R, prosecuting, told the court, "There are a series of very serious attacks on moped and motorcycle riders. The modus operandi of all the offenses is identical. The attacks occur as the moped rider is at a red light. The corrosive liquid is sprayed directly onto the face or under the visor of the rider. As the rider is struggling with pain and disorientation, we say that the attackers steal or attempt to steal the vehicle. One of the victims had a very serious injury and may lose the sight in one eye." Meanwhile, late on Monday night, another teenager was charged over a separate suspected acid attack in London on July 4th. Mustafa Ahmed, 19, was charged with one count of wounding with intent to do grievous bodily harm and one count of attempted wounding with intent to do grievous bodily harm. He will appear before Thames Magistrates Court on Tuesday. Two victims, a man in his 20s, and a woman in her 40s, had to be taken to hospital for treatment following that incident in Mile End, East London. Scotland Yard said three other teenagers arrested on suspicion of GBH. Don't you love these abbreviations? We always have to go back and search. What did they mean? This was grievous bodily harm. So these three other teenagers were arrested on suspicion of this, and they've all been released under investigation. Now, there's more, isn't there, Lou?
That's right. That line states, Minneapolis police fatally shot an Australian woman after hearing, quote, loud sound, unquote, investigators say, by Mark Berman, July 19th. Investigators probing the death of an Australian woman who was fatally shot by Minneapolis police officers over the weekend said Tuesday that the officers were, quote, startled by a loud sound, unquote, near their patrol car right before the shooting. The two officers were driving through an alley near the home of Justine DeMond, 40, after she called 911 late Saturday to report a possible assault, according to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the state agency investigating the shooting. The officer who was driving the patrol car told investigators that right after the loud noise, DeMond approached the car on his side. The officer who was in the passenger seat then fatally shot DeMond through the driver's side window, according to investigators. State investigators on Tuesday identified the officer who shot DeMond as Mohammed Noor, who joined the department in 2015, and said the officer driving was Matthew Harity, who joined the force last year. Both officers were placed on standard administrative leave after the shooting. Authorities said no weapon was found at the scene of the shooting, but they found a cell phone near DeMond. Relatives say DeMond had called 911 on Saturday night to report what she thought was a sexual assault near her home. Officials say Nora and Harity responded to the call just before 11:30 p.m. What happened in DeMond's final moments has been shrouded in mystery for 3 days. But about 20 minutes after the 911 call, she was dead, killed by a single gunshot to the abdomen. Investigators confirmed Tuesday that they have not found any video or audio that captured the shooting. Both officers were wearing body cameras, but the cameras were not turned on until after the shooting, investigators said, though they did not say why. The squad car camera also was not turned on. The BCA, that's another one of our abbreviations, that's the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, stated. The shooting has drawn international attention and been decried as a nightmare in DeMond's home country of Australia. Her relatives have pleaded for any information about what happened before she was shot and killed, saying they were desperate for information. Quote, Our hearts are broken, and we are utterly devastated by the loss of Justine, Don DeMond, her fiancé, said Monday at a news briefing in Minneapolis. He said that understanding her last moments would be a small comfort as we grieve this tragedy. Nora currently has had three complaints filed against him with the City Office of Police Conduct Review, two of which are still open. The other complaint did not result in any disciplinary action, and any records regarding complaints are not made public unless an officer is disciplined. Quote, there are big questions left that we still have and that we hope to have answered soon, Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges said. Why did Officer Nora draw and fire his gun? What happened from the time the officers arrived on the scene to when she was pronounced dead? Why don't we have footage from body cameras? Why were they not activated? We all want answers to these questions. And in connection with this, we also have a report from InfoWars by Kit Daniels. He states, this is dated, by the way, July 18th, he states, CBS is pushing gun control in response to the questionable shooting of an Australian woman by a Somali migrant cop, despite gun control advocates constantly claiming only cops should carry guns. Additionally, the mainstream media doesn't seem too motivated to report on the story, given it wasn't a white cop shooting a Muslim, nor is there much reporting on the possibility the shooting was Sharia-inspired or part of a criminal cover-up. And this is Luke Haverly interjecting. Now, criminal cover-up? Cover-up of a sexual assault? We are reminded now of a terrible scene in Baden-Württemberg, Germany, that Elizabeth will now report on.
And again, this is Kit Daniels, InfoWars.com, July 17th. Migrants turn German festival into rape fest. 17-year-old festival goer held down by three Afghan migrants. The so-called asylum seekers invaded the Volksfest in Baden-Württemberg over the weekend, committing three sexual assaults on Friday alone and more throughout the festivities. One of the victims was a 17-year-old girl who was held down by three Afghan migrants, according to police. The police also believe there are more rape victims who have not yet reported the crimes. We hope that further possible victims or witnesses report to us, said a police official in nearby Aalen. Additionally, around 1,000 youths gathered at Schorndorf Castle near the festival grounds and chunked bottles at visitors and police. The situation is so bad that German police were forced to admit the suspects arrested, including Muslim migrants. They were forced to admit the suspects arrested included Muslim migrants, a fact they normally try to conceal from the public. The violence towards the police was frightening, an official stated, adding that it was unheard of until now. The mayor of Schorndorf, Matthias Klopfer, had some unusually strong words to say about the violence. Given that German politicians typically preach tolerance in response to migrant rape, quote, it is crystal clear we don't tolerate such excesses, we don't give room for lawlessness, and we have zero tolerance for violence, sexual assaults, and attacks against the police, he said. But it remains to be seen what will happen to the migrants who are arrested. As I previously reported, and again, this is Kit Daniels from InfoWars, Germany is on track to legalize rape due to the lack of prosecution against migrant rapists. You know, we have to interject. This is just unbelievable. We're seeing the fall of Europe, whether they realize it or not. But back to Kit Daniels. Typically, rapes by migrants are downplayed as cultural misunderstandings, and thus the victims never receive justice, meaning it's practically legal for Muslim migrants to rape Germans. Quote, after importing real rape culture into their sciences, excuse me again, into their societies, the people of Germany are rarely successful at reporting cases against Muslim miscreants, and even more rarely at winning them, end of quote, remarked Damian Black of Return of Kings. Police would rather cover up these crimes, including rapes of their own women, than risk their careers and income for fear of being branded an Islamophobe in a multicultural society. One national study showed that less than 10% of men that are accused of rape are convicted. And I have to interject here before Lou continues that as a woman in America, I think that we must stand up against this. We cannot have our Western civilization torn down, our Christian civilization torn down here. But you'll hear later in the program about a church being sold as a mosque in Smithfield, North Carolina. But back to Lou.
Ah, back to the case of Mohammed Noor and the shooting of Justine DeMond. Kit Daniels comments, it's funny how CBS was quick to blame America's so-called, quote, culture of gun violence, unquote, despite later admitting, quote, authorities have released no details on what prompted Saturday's shooting, unquote. We don't even know if the cop, 31-year-old Mohammed Noor, embraced American culture in any capacity. He may have been a stalwart supporter of Sharia law, for all we know. Minneapolis is a primary detention, a destination for Somali Muslims migrating to the U.S., and there have been numerous FBI probes into potential terrorist cells in the city. The largest Somali diaspora community in the United States lives in Minnesota, states the Somali Museum of Minnesota. Now I just wanted to read a couple of quick selections from a book entitled Refugee Resettlement by Ann Cochran. One ethnic group, the Pew, and that's the Pew Research Foundation, told us is growing rapidly, and one might think would be easier to track because they are virtually 100% Muslim, are the Somalis. But the following points out how hard it is to get accurate numbers for just this one Muslim ethnic group in the U.S., largely because of reluctance by the Somalis to identify themselves and speak with the census taker. From 1983 to 93, a total of 4,413 Somalis were admitted as refugees. From 1994 to 2001, the highest admission year was 2000, with 6,002 Somalis, and the lowest was 1995, with only 2,524. The number dropped precipitously in 2002, when fear spread that Somalis might harbor terrorists in the refugee population arriving from Africa. The total number admitted to the U.S. was only 242. Then began the Bush years that saw the largest numbers arrive from a high of 12,814 in 2004 to a low of 6,958 in 2007. In 2008, the number dropped again because the U.S. State Department discovered widespread fraud in the Family Reunification Program for Africans, primarily Somalis, and closed the program for several years. The discovery and closure was reported by the Wall Street Journal reporter Miriam Jordan in August of 2008. Ultimately, the U.S. State Department estimated that 20,000 to 30,000 entered the U.S. illegally in the preceding decade, but no one was ever deported for the immigration fraud. Gradually, during the Obama years, the Somali refugee numbers have climbed steadily, reaching 9,000 in fiscal year 2014. That brings the total number resettled through this one legal immigration avenue to 118,479 Somalis who have been busy for 30 years increasing their numbers through higher birth rates than those of Americans or other ethnic groups. The top three U.S. metropolitan areas, according to the U.S. Census Bureau for Somalis, are in this order: Minneapolis, 17,320, Columbus, Ohio, 8,280, and Seattle, 7,850. However, I, and that's Ann Cochran, the author of the book, expect the numbers are much higher because of trust and language problems related to census gathering. A USA Today story in November 2014 about school integration problems in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, involving the growing Somali population there, puts the Somali population of the whole state of Minnesota at 32,000. I expect further study will find that 32,000 is a low number. Daryl, I believe you have some very significant information from Crescent Moon Rising by Paul Williams that will further explain the mysterious Somalis in America. See, Daryl, do we have you there? Well, we may have lost Daryl.
I wonder whether he's lost Daryl there. perhaps our producer can get him back on. We hope he can. Until he does, Paul Williams is a Pennsylvanian, and he's written an important book called Crescent Moon Rising, The Islamic Transformation of America. And as Daryl pointed out, you can get this at Barnes & Noble. I'm sure you could get it on Amazon, some other places. And so we know that these are people who,
yeah, I'm back.
Said, we're coming in, yes, we're coming into America. And now Daryl will give you more facts on this.
Okay, I lost you guys for a little bit there. So
oh, and we're
right
going, we just said that you would be going into Crescent Moon Rising by Paul L. Williams and give us more data from Chapter 14, especially there, about the Somali, shall we say, the mini-invasion.
Right. And again, folks, we talked about this book before, and if there's one book you can get your hands on, as far as I know, it's still available probably from your large bookstores, or of course you could go up on the internet and do a search for it, but it's called Crescent Moon Rising by Paul L. Williams. It's probably one of the best books you could ever get your hands on about the Islamic, the subtitle is The Islamic Transformation of America. But this problem that we've got with this massive influx of Muslim immigrants coming into our country and supposedly doing a peaceful jihad, which is kind of an oxymoron. But to Chapter 14 is the resettling of the Somalis. And, of course, they've been coming in places like in Tennessee, in Pennsylvania. And the problem with the Somalis, and, of course, they are up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, is that most of them don't speak English. They don't even try to assimilate. And that's what he brings out in Chapter 14 here is this resettlement problem with the Somalis is not going well anywhere. And another book that we had talked about before on your broadcast, the one that you had mailed to me, is that there's a lot of places across the country that are bringing these people in. And like I said, especially with the Somalis, they're not assimilating. The local area is not given any input on these folks. And, of course, crime is going up quite a bit. And I'm sure you're probably going to cover some of that or will cover it later on the broadcast here. But one of the big problems that they got is recruiting people from these groups, the Somalis, to go over and fight in Somalia and other places. Al-Shabaab is one of the worst super militant Sunni Islamic terrorist groups in the world. It's headquartered in Somalia. It even crosses the border, I believe, into Kenya and other places, and is killing Christians, torturing Christians, crucifying Christians. But these people in Minneapolis, St. Paul, they're basically serving as a recruitment center. And it's not just Al-Shabaab, it's other groups, Hezbollah, Hamas. These are also recruiting people in the United States, not just from the Somali community, but from Syria and other places, Muslims that are coming into the country. They're going over, they're getting military training, and they're getting combat, actual combat experience. And then the great fear is, of course, is right after they get the combat experience, if they survive over there, they're going to come back here to the U.S. Trained for terrorist acts and equipped much better to fight as a terrorist. And so it's a great problem for the United States of America to be having these people from Somalia and other places coming in here. And again, like I mentioned, with Somalis, they're just not even trying to assimilate. And, of course, there's a drug problem that comes along with this. And, of course, in some places in the Arab world, it's called khat. It's a leaf that they it's a narcotic and a hallucinogen that the Drug Enforcement Administration, I should say, lists as one of the world's most dangerous substances. So we got the problem of the drugs coming in with them, and they evidently don't have too much trouble getting it in here. But then again, the problem you got here is you've got these different gangs of thugs that are coming from the Horn of Africa. And in his book, he mentions three different groups: the Somali Hot Boys, the Somali Mafia, and the Mudhaban. And I'd have to see that with attitude in Arabic to know the exact correct pronunciation of that. But it's becoming a major crime element, and he lists such cities as San Diego, California, and Nashville, Tennessee, and in small towns throughout the country, including Greeley, Colorado, Clarkston, Georgia, Jamestown, North Dakota, Garden City, Kansas. And I'd mentioned on a previous broadcast, we've had Somalis brought in here into Pennsylvania, Syrians brought in, even into the capital of Pennsylvania, Harrisburg. And I get reports from some of the folks out there in Harrisburg. So we've got a big problem here with not just the Somalis, but Syrians and others. And a lot of folks don't report that they're being helped a lot, even by groups like the U.S. Conference of Bishops and that encourage this and try to help them out a lot when they come in to, they have what they call preferred areas for them to settle, and so they're getting information and brochures and that where to go around the country to get the best welfare. And they mention a town here like in Lewiston, Maine, that was overwhelmed by these Somalis. They only had a population of 30,000 people up there, and then they've got all these thousands of Somalis coming in. So it's a big problem all around the country. And again, it's just not causing crime, and it's not just causing a tremendous financial burden on those communities, but they're serving as recruiting centers for volunteers to go fight in Hezbollah and al-Shabaab and a lot of other different Muslim terrorist groups around the world. So it's a very, very, very big problem.
I think this is very serious, and you know, in that chapter, I'll just make a quick quote from Shelbyville. Shelbyville was, do you remember, Daryl? I'm not sure whether it was in Tennessee.
I think that's in Tennessee.
Is that Tennessee? And this was just an eyewitness. Now, again, what you've said is even more serious, the recruitment for terrorism that will come back home, come back on us. This was everyday life. Now, you listeners, think about this. Is this what you want? They, the Somalis, had no respect for neighbors and had bad odors would come from their apartment into the halls and then into other people's apartments. They also would hit other people's vehicles and then claim they didn't do it, and also would get confrontational with other people and try and start arguments and fights. They would also run in and out all times of the night while yelling in the hallways and outside. My friends got to the point where they were afraid to come over. They totally brought the standard of living down at the apartment complex. It was a nice little place before that. I got tired of it after a while and moved into a house. They would be warned of the rules there, but would continually break them, and they didn't care. They thought they were above that and treated the rest of the residents as though they were the outsiders. And so all of this is an assault on our very way of life, and we have a lot more to cover, but I think Daryl has brought out some extremely important points. And again, you might reiterate, Daryl, I believe that you said people who were Muslims were being bussed in under the orders of the highest levels of the state government in Pennsylvania. Is that right?
Exactly right. Governor Wolf authorized to bring these folks in. And another problem we're having in America are these cities, what do they call them? The sanctuary cities, that they don't even want to obey federal law. They don't want to report these people when they commit serious crimes. They don't want to report them to immigration and follow federal law, et cetera, but yet they get funding. So I'm hoping that the federal government will at least cut the funding off assisting these people, because they are going to certain areas of the country because and they're being advised where they can get the best welfare benefits.
Exactly.
And that's something that...
And we do have to worry greatly if Jeff Sessions is on the way out, if he was really trying to actively stop the immigration, and if they are trying to put in Friends of Umar Abedin, you see, this is the Muslim Brotherhood coming right back under control. And so we need deep prayer to prevent this. And now we have to see the situation in England. And then a little later, we're going to move to the question of what's happening down there in Smithville, North Carolina. Lou, you have a lot, and then I have a little more about London and England.
Yes, this is written by Giulio Miotti, dated April the 2nd, 2017. It says, British multiculturalists are feeding Islamic fundamentalism. Muslims do not need to become the majority in the UK. They just need gradually to Islamize the most important cities. The change is already taking place. British personalities keep opening the door to introducing Islamic Sharia law. One of the leading British judges, Sir James Munby, said that Christianity no longer influences the courts, and these must be multicultural, which means more Islamic. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury and Chief Justice Lord Phillips, also suggested that the English law should, quote-unquote, incorporate elements of Sharia law. British universities are also advancing Islamic law. The academic guidelines, quote, external speakers in higher educational institutions, unquote, provide that orthodox religious groups, that also is in quotes, orthodox religious groups may separate men and women during events. At the Queen Mary University of London, women have had to use a separate entrance and were forced to sit in a room without being able to ask questions or raise their hand, just as in Riyadh or Tehran. Quote, London is more Islamic than many Muslim countries put together, unquote, according to Maulana Syed Raza Rizvi, one of the Islamic preachers who now lead Londonistan. That's a little made-up word there, Londonistan, as a journalist, Melanie Phillips, has called the English capital. No, Rizvi is not a right-wing extremist. Wol Soyinka, a Nobel laureate for literature, was less generous. He called the UK a, quote, cesspit for Islamists. Demographically, Britain has been acquiring an increasingly Islamic face in places such as Birmingham, Bradford, Derby, Dewsbury, Leeds, Leicester, Liverpool, Luton, Manchester, Sheffield, Waltham Forest, and Tower Hamlets. In 2015, an analysis of the most common name in England showed it was Mohammed, including spelling variations such as Muhammad and Mohammed, with an A-D on the end. Most important cities have huge Muslim populations. Manchester, it's 15.8%. Birmingham, 21.8%. And Bradford, 24.7%. And I should add a little personal note. I think my ancestors, the Caverleys, came from the area near Bradford originally in Yorkshire. Going back to the article in Birmingham.
Wouldn't they be appalled?
They most certainly would be. Very appalled to hear these statistics. Back to the article. In Birmingham, the police just dismantled a terrorist cell. There is also a greater probability that a child would be born into a Muslim family than into a Christian one. In Bradford and Leicester, half the children are Muslim. Muslims do not need to become the majority in the UK. They just need gradually to Islamize the most important cities. And we're repeating now something they already said. The change is already taking place. Londonistan is not a Muslim majority nightmare. It is a cultural, demographic, and religious hybrid in which Christianity declines and Islam advances. According to Inez Bowen, writing in The Spectator, only two of the 1,700 mosques in Britain today follow the modernist interpretation of Islam, compared with 56% in the United States. The Wahhabis control 6% of mosques in the UK, while the fundamentalist Diobandi control up to 45%. According to a survey from the Knowledge Center, a third of UK Muslims do not feel, quote, part of British culture, unquote. After the attack on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, the head of MI6, Sir John Sawyers, I guess that's pronounced, recommended self-censorship and, quote, some restraint, unquote, in discussing Islam. The British ambassador in Saudi Arabia, Simon Callis, converted to Islam and completed the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj. He now calls himself Haji Callis.
And continuing in that same article, terrorists cannot stand London multiculturalism. London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, said after the recent deadly terror attack at Westminster, the opposite is true. British multiculturalists are feeding Islamic fundamentalism. Above all, Londonistan, with its new 423 mosques, is built on the sad ruins of English Christianity. The Hyatt United Church was bought by the Egyptian community to be converted to a mosque. St. Peter's Church has been converted into the Medina Mosque. The Brick Lane Mosque was built on a former Methodist church. Not only buildings are converted, but also people. The number of converts to Islam has doubled. Often they embrace radical Islam, as with Khalid Massoud, the terrorist who struck Westminster. The Daily Mail published photographs of a church and a mosque a few meters from each other in the heart of London. At the Church of San Giorgio, designed to accommodate 1,230 worshipers, only 12 people gathered to celebrate Mass. At the Church of Santa Maria, there were 20. The nearby Broome Street Estate Mosque has a different problem, overcrowding. It's a small room and can contain only 100. On Friday, the faithful must pour into the street to pray. Given the current trends, Christianity in England is becoming a relic, while Islam will be the religion of the future. In Birmingham, the second largest British city, where many jihadists live and orchestrate their attacks, an Islamic minaret dominates the sky. There are petitions to allow British mosques to call the Islamic faithful to prayer on loudspeakers three times a day. By 2020, estimates are that the number of Muslims attending prayers will reach at least 683,000, while the number of Christians attending weekly Mass will drop to 679,000. Quote, "The new cultural landscape of English cities has arrived. The homogenized Christian landscape of state religion is in retreat," said Sari Peach of Oxford University. While nearly half of British Muslims are under the age of 25, a quarter of Christians are under 65. In another 20 years, there are going to be more active Muslims than there are churchgoers, said Keith Porteous Wood, director of the National Secular Society. Since 2001, 500 London churches of all denominations have been turned into private homes. During the same period, British mosques have been proliferating. Between 2012 and 2014, the proportion of Britons who identify themselves as Anglicans fell from 21% to 17%, a decrease of 1.7 million people, while, according to a survey conducted by the respected NatSen Social Research Institute, the number of Muslims has grown by almost a million. Churchgoers are declining at a rate that within a generation, their number will be three times lower than that of Muslims who go regularly to mosque on Friday. And so you're thinking, well, I'm safe here in America. Nothing's going to happen here, but we have some important news from North Carolina and from Connecticut. And we're going to get Daryl Eberhardt's take as a political analyst, an intelligence analyst, and as a Christian man and an American. Smithfield, May 12, 2017. It won't be the first mosque in Johnston County, but for now it's the only one. On Saturday morning, the Islamic Center of Smithfield will open up in a vacant Pentecostal church, taking over the four-acre property and parsonage on Brightleaf Boulevard with future plans for a worship and community center and school. Helping to open the mosque will be local Christian clergy, hoping to strike a welcoming and respectful tone for two faiths of similar origins in a shared community. And by the way, I first heard this shocking report with Pastor David Langford, and I think that I heard him on shortwave 4.840 at midnight on a Sunday evening a couple weeks ago, and I could hardly believe this. Back to the article, crosses have been removed from the former church's facade and steeple, and Ali Mohammed, an organizer of the mosque and a Smithfield business owner, said they'll be handed over to the group of pastors as a show of good faith. "We want to be friendly with all our neighbors and let them know we're there," Mohammed said. "It's open faith. We're brothers." And I would point out that Pastor David Langford said this was an act of submission, you see, when they handed the crosses back to these pastors, these ecumenical pastors, these blind hirelings. See John 10 for that. We may not have time to read it, but you look up John, chapter 10, and you'll see who these pastors really are. Anyway, it's saying basically these crosses are worthless. And you see, by accepting them back, the pastors are really going into submission. The last Johnston County mosque was in Selma, but it folded a few years ago after a series of break-ins, and the imam left for Goldsboro to help open an Islamic center there. Muhammad, who owns several local strip malls and businesses that sell speakers and security systems, said he let the county's Muslim community meet in one of his vacant storefronts, but that it was always considered temporary. One of our dreams was we could start a bigger Islamic center so our kids can play, we can create a small school, we can create a place for all these families to get together and hang out, Muhammad said. And he goes on to say that they looked for properties last year and they came across this empty Pentecostal church. And it included a church building and a home. And they bought the four-acre property last month for $230,000. Now, let's get the take of these so-called ecumenical pastors. Pastor Jim Melnick, and that's capital M-E-L-N-Y-K, who leads St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Smithfield, will be one of the Christian church leaders taking part in Saturday's ceremony. He said Christianity and Islam share common origins and scriptures, and that he felt it was important to participate in the mosque opening as a sign of mutual respect. Quote, "I see it as an important statement of community that we take each other's faith seriously," Melnick said. "I want to acknowledge how important it is to build bridges in the community when we're living in a time that is so anxiety-ridden and there's so much mistrust going on in the world around us. It's important when we can find common ground and share our community." And it goes on to talk about Muhammad. He was born in Venezuela to Jerusalem-born parents, and he came to Smithfield 20 years ago via Florida. And he said at that time the Muslim community was about three or four families, and now it has grown to be about 60. And he said, "Part of it is destiny. It's the will of God that we're here, and we've done well," Muhammad said. Daryl Eberhardt, would you like to comment on this shocking development?
Right, and we had talked about that a couple broadcasts before where we mentioned about this. One of the ways that they want to take over different countries, if they can take them militarily, they'll try to take them militarily. But they call what they have da'wah, and that literally means a call or a summons, but it's proselytizing. And the main way they're doing that is through immigration, sending in guest workers, and also through marriage, through marrying the local natives. And here's an interesting figure. You sent me a wonderful DVD that I watched, Islam Rising, A Call to One World Ummah. And on there, they had
a number of different... Yes, let's get into that. Go ahead and feel free to enlarge all of that.
Okay, well, they had one of the speakers, and they had a lot of good authors on there, and I did pick up a number of their books. But one of the men that spoke there was Kamal Saleem. He was a former PLO terrorist who became a Christian when he had an accident and three Christians befriended him in the United States of America. Here's some of the interesting things he said. Every 5.5 days, a new mosque is built in the United States of America. Every 5.5 days, we have a new mosque or Islamic center being built in the USA. And we covered this before, but it's still important. He also mentioned that 80% of these mosques that are and Islamic centers that are being built in the United States of America are being paid for by the Saudi Arabians, the Wahhabi Sunni Islam branch of Islam, and most of the people running these, and Paul Williams brings that out in his book, Crescent Moon Rising, most of the people running these are not moderate, friendly Muslims, as we were told by the former president, Barack Hussein Obama. They are being run by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a terrorist group that grew out of Egypt, spread to other Arab countries, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and that are all, if you would, children or grandchildren of Wahhabi Sunni Islam. So here we have in the United States, all these mosques and Islamic centers, being over 80% of them, being funded by Saudi Arabia and being manned, the vast majority of them, by the Muslim Brotherhood, a terrorist group that is still listed as a terrorist group in some countries like Egypt. And it's over here and there. These mosques are nothing but breeding grounds for terrorists. And not only are the terrorists being recruited from the Syrian Muslims, the Somali Muslims that are coming here. They're being recruited from our black communities in Brooklyn and New York, from what they call black Muslims. But they're also being recruited from white individuals. And again, one of their keys to undermining Western countries, they're actually telling young Muslim males to come over to the United States and befriend and court women who are non-Muslims, including Christians, and promise them all kinds of good things, that they'll love them forever and take them back to their countries, and that they're rich, and often they're lying. And what happens is they have children, and the children are, the women are coerced into having the children become Muslims. And so we're actually breeding, they're breeding, they're using American women in the United States of America, and of course in Europe, different countries there. They're using women to breed Muslims for jihad, for a later violent jihad. And I say we can't really separate it and say that da'wah is the peaceful proselytizing through, again, immigration and marriage and having guest workers here. But
no, we can't.
You can't really separate.
And we can't be blind when the Melnick, this Episcopal pastor, thinks that he's doing right to be showing all this brotherhood, because it's important that he said that the ceremony of the transfer of the church to the mosque was what he wants the public to recognize. They're reaching out to be neighborly, saying, we know this symbol is important to you and we want to honor it. And it behooves us as Christians and followers of Jesus to be neighborly in response. If I had concerns, I wouldn't be involved. Christianity is meant to be hard, to challenge you to go into the tough places. I see this as a very positive thing, and if anyone is hurt or offended by it, I challenge them to read the Gospels a little more closely. Muhammad said Saturday will feature readings from the Quran and the Bible and remarks from members of both faiths, followed in their religious way with refreshments. And if we consult our Bible in the Old Testament, God never advocated his people joining with the other pagan societies. Never. And Lou, quickly, what about Connecticut?
There's an old congregational church, one of the ones that dates back a long time ago. That was the original church of the original settlers there, the congregational church. It's also become a mosque in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
It's shocking. John 10:11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for his sheep. But he that is an hireling and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming and leaveth the sheep and fleeth. And the wolf catches them and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth because he is an hireling and careth not for the sheep. This has been a very vital program. We hope that you will tell all of your friends and your pastors to go eventually to our archives, thedividedkingdom.org. Within 2 weeks, we hope this will be in there, thedividedkingdom.org. We can't thank you enough, Captain Darrell Eberhardt, and I know we'll be talking to you again soon. God bless you, Darrell.
And God bless you.
Thank you for listening to The Divided Kingdom, and keep our country in prayer. The last horrible headline was Muslims horrifically murdered 250 children, but the UN silences the investigation. Good night.